This is Arrivals, stories of migration, transformation, and change. The program that explores what we do when what we've done is a thing of the past. It's been 5 years since a 9.0 earthquake rocked Japan, but the images from that time are indelible. The wall of water devouring parts of the Japanese coastline and cars lifting over walls and tumbling into the sides of buildings. Then there's all the fear and uncertainty that followed. When the tsunami caused the meltdown of a nuclear power plant, the whole world was watching. And it's in this climate of uncertainty that Junji Nishihara and his family found themselves. Not quite foreigners, and in many ways, not quite Japanese either. What does it feel like to be an outsider in the middle of a national crisis? Today on Arrivals, we go back in time to Japan, 2011.
My name is Junji Nishihara. I'm 46 years old. My grandparents had come from Japan my grandfather came first, but my grandmother came in 1920, I think it was. And my father was then born in Vancouver. As a Japanese Canadian, I'd kind of avoided going for a long time. I had this image that I wouldn't like it being there, that I had too many preconceptions of what the life and society and culture was like. So when I actually went, it was quite a surprise, and I found myself very much at ease in the place. And I had just turned 30 that year, and that was the last year of eligibility for working holiday visa. Most people have never met a Japanese born overseas. Most people have never met a second or third generation. They've heard of them vaguely, but they don't really get it. So a lot of foreigners, to use for want of a better term, will arrive in Japan and they enjoy a certain kind of a status because they speak English or they're tall or they obviously stand out. But the halfway people like me, they really don't know what to do with them. There's an interaction and a depth to the relationships between Japanese people that is very demanding personally, but they don't do that with everyone. So here in North America, you can kind of make friends with more or less anybody if you have some kind of common interest or common ground. But in Japan, those kinds of relationships are usually more defined by society. So for example, when you start school, the people at your class and your level, those are your friends. And people in different classes or different grades generally are not your friends. So when you start in a company, usually it's lifetime employment, how it used to be. You would join in a certain group or in a certain wave of graduation, those are your friends. When you leave the company, they're not your friends anymore. You don't talk to them anymore. It's over. So it's very hard to understand. So what is the personal relationship? And that's where it gets very tricky. You show up as a sort of half Japanese and somewhat aware of this, but seeing how it happens, how it really plays out over the course of people's lives as you get to know them in companies, it's very different. I lived in a few places in Tokyo. My favorite was the one where we were last living, in Inokashira. And Inokashira is famous because of the park, Inokashira Koen, as it's called. Compared to London and New York, where you have something like 26 square meters of park place per capita, in Tokyo, the ratio is only about 5 meters of park place per capita. So living next to a large park of any kind in Tokyo is already a huge bonus. But on top of that, Inokashira had a real thriving street performance scene. So on the weekends, you would get all kinds of jugglers and street performers doing their thing. So it had a real funky, original feel, which was really, really comfortable. And we're living in this old-style Japanese house. It was, by Tokyo standards, very old, over 50 years old, with tatami floors and so on. So it was a great neighborhood. It was an excellent spot to live. And lots of other mixed families, foreign and Japanese couples, so the children felt quite comfortable. The density of the whole neighborhood, the whole structure of it, was intense. and to the other side of the street as well. So that basically there was a feeling, and it's a feeling I always had in Japan, is you couldn't see the sky. Even in a low-rise, low-developed neighborhood without any tall buildings, there was cables overhead, a few trees, but it just felt more crowded, your line of sight. So with that kind of infrastructure there, it served as a kind of reminder of the social structures that seemed to make everything always a bit more complicated. Spring to me is the best time of year in Tokyo, for sure. You'll get fair, clear, sunny days, and then you'll have the sakura, the cherry blossom season, which is only about a week long. The weather starts to turn nice, and you have picnics everywhere. It's a delight. It's so much fun. You would have constant weather reports on the TV predicting when the sakura season would start. I had friends who would send me daily emails, you know, any day now. One guy I know who was a manager in a big Japanese company, he would send his employees out. If they found a spot that was looking good, they would reserve from 3 a.m. the night before. They would have somebody camp out overnight to reserve their picnic spot. And then they would all show up at 9:00 a.m, day off work, and drink all day long. Sakura season starts, obviously it varies depending on the weather, but end of March, first week of April. And the sakura will stay in bloom for, I think the shortest I saw was 4 days, so the longest was 10 days, something like that. And that year in particular, everyone suspended their picnics. The entire country did not picnic for sakura season that year because they felt guilty over the 22,000 people who had died. I was at the office the day the earthquake struck. It was Friday. The earthquake happened at about, I think it was 3 p.m. It was just a regular day, quite busy. And then the shaking struck. There had been a quake the week before, which was quite big. One of the bigger ones I had felt in the 10 years or so I was in Tokyo. But feeling earthquakes was nothing unusual. But when this one struck, I knew it was huge. It was just massive. The building shook and shook and shook. I was working in Odaiba, which is reclaimed land in Tokyo Bay, on the 18th floor of the Shell building. And when a 25-story building shakes like that, it is something else. You feel like you're at sea. The building feels like it's not only going left and right, but up and down to some extent. So there's a sudden liquidity to the entire world that is really, really overwhelming. Everyone hid under their desk. There was some people who were screaming, and then later on we could see smoke emerging from a building just two streets away, and further down on Chiba Peninsula we could see fires were starting at one of the refineries that had exploded. And then as the quaking stopped, we went through our standard emergency drill, which was basically for everyone to leave the building. So we did that. Everyone had a helmet and a backpack at the company. So we grabbed all that stuff. I didn't have my helmet, so I used my bicycle helmet because I'd ridden my bicycle to work that day. I gave my helmet to somebody else, I think. And then we assembled outside, and all the way down the stairs and so on, the Japanese were being quite blasé about it, saying, well, we've been through quakes before, and kind of teasing foreigners, saying, well, this must have been a big one for you, I guess, and that kind of thing. But even the Japanese didn't realize how much damage had been done. That didn't happen until later on when the tsunamis hit, and then the news reporting came the following day. So at the time, it just felt like, oh, okay, that was a big one. No big deal. But we stayed outside, and they didn't call the all clear for about an hour, which was also unusual. Then we went upstairs, and work did not resume because then people began to realize that the trains weren't running. And with the trains not running in Tokyo, it's impossible. It's impossible to get around.
今日午後2時46分ごろ、三陸沖を震源地とするマグニチュード8.8の巨大地震が起きました。
Rather a stupid way, I actually felt kind of excited. And so we camped out and I turned the TV on and we were watching the news to see what was going on. And then I began to see the reports of the tsunamis that had hit further up the coast in Tohoku. And then it began to hit me that it was much more serious than I had realized. And then the following day, when I saw the reports of what was coming out of Fukushima, then I felt this pit in my stomach. Where I thought, oh shit, this is very, very serious. This is a crisis, a major crisis. So we turned on, and that's when they interrupted this broadcast with a live report from Fukushima. And there was, I think it was before the helicopters had shown up. And you could sort of see from a distance the reactors and some towers and so on. And then this sudden plume of vaguely visible steam comes bursting out from somewhere. And that was the extent of the explosion. But it's a nuclear reactor, so any kind of explosion is not good. Definitely fits into the cap, with all caps, not good category. So fortunately, there weren't any other bursts after that. But I was starting watching very closely what they were doing. And then when the helicopters were coming out to try and drop water, I realized that they did not know how to contain it. And so that's when I began to wonder, can we stay? What is it safe? What's going to happen? What if the whole thing goes up? It's basically, it's a major sea level rise. I used to have an image of tsunami like these giant waves like cresting and the kind of thing people would surf on. No, it's just the water just starts to rise and rise and rise, and as it rises it comes inland, 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 and there's just nothing to do. You gotta run like hell. And so some of the footage on TV, there was people's cars driving down the road, whoop, turn around and they could escape. But I saw one, it was frightening, was an entire train flipped on its side. Obviously you can't do anything when you're on a train. And it had just been scoured clean. Nobody left inside. Did they get away? I don't think so. Entire villages were left away. Totally gone. People started leaving right away. What happened? What's important to remember in this company I was in? It was a Japanese company with investment from Shell Oil. And so there was a number of Shell Oil executives were executives in our company, and as such they were foreigners. And because they had executive power, they would pick up and leave. Technically, I was bound by my Japanese work contract. And all the Japanese, none of them left. They didn't see anything wrong with the situation. They didn't see any danger whatsoever. And they didn't even have the option to leave anyhow. There was no for them to go. There was no clear direction from the Japanese government that this was an evacuation situation. So for someone to leave their job was a tantamount to quitting. And so you realized how much of a delicate machine, Japan in particular, but pretty much any developed economy is. It depends on this continuous supply of goods and logistics and shipping and infrastructure and all that stuff. And if there's some glitch, like a big earthquake, it all comes tumbling down. So people began to stockpile, they were hoarding. Toilet paper was a big one, so you can imagine a week without toilet paper, my God. So when this situation began to hit, you know, Kashirda, and my wife was getting very concerned, I began to envision the possibility that they would call for a mass evacuation of Tokyo. With a city of 30 million people, and you would suddenly have to get on. We didn't have a car in those days. I just thought, forget it. We have to do something now and get ahead of the curve, especially with young children. Shu was 4 years old and Coco was 3. So rather than taking any chance, I decided to go to Kyoto, where at least it was going to be safer. Kyoto itself is known for relatively few earthquakes. It's on a more stable plate. And it was, of course, far away from Fukushima. And we got there in the evening, and it took us a moment to find our we found this temporary apartment thing, not a hotel, you know, sort of a slightly longer term stay place where we could also do our own cooking. But obviously we hadn't brought anything with us, so we had to go to the restaurant. So we go to this family restaurant, as they call them in Japan, you know, family fair type place. And we even had our own little booth. That's so nice in Japan. You get these little booths at the sliding door, you know. We sit down there, and I can't remember why. The children were unsettled and crying and complaining. And I remember just sitting with my head in my hands, and I really thought that my head was going to explode because of feeling this pressure between this Japanese and non-Japanese, what's right and what's wrong, who has the monopoly on the truth. Because it really felt like that was what I was sitting in the middle of, was not just an earthquake, but a real question of what was actually happening. I did not have the full information. I'll never forget that moment where I felt like I was on a precipice above a chasm. And this is where it gets very, very complicated, because the U.S. Army and Navy were also advising the Japanese government. And so finally at one point, the Japanese government declared that the 20-kilometer zone around Fukushima was a no-go zone. I forget exactly when that happened. But the U.S. Navy itself said, actually, that zone is 50 kilometers for U.S. Navy personnel. So the obvious conclusion is that it's 50 kilometers, right? That was typical of the kind of conflicting information that we were getting in those days. You couldn't really tell who was saying the correct news, what the implications were. Then Greenpeace showed up and started saying that the arbitrary circular radius defined didn't make any sense because the winds were blowing in one particular direction. So there could be a whole part of the area which would be fine to be in, and other parts were more heavily affected. And they didn't have the right machines to even measure the radiation. And later on, it was shown that TEPCO, the company that runs the nuclear power plant, had Geiger counters that only counted up to 100 rams, or rems, I think they're called, whereas the area was getting levels about 10 times as high. So they couldn't even measure what they were doing. There was a sense of waiting, of this pressure building. And on top of that, in the weeks following the quake were many, many aftershocks. And I think that month there were something like 600 earthquakes. I mean, the entire main island of Japan moved 6 meters to the west or something that day. Just insane. But those aftershocks were so debilitating. just getting headaches. You couldn't concentrate at work. Everything would start shaking periodically every hour or so. The whole building would shake. Minor shaking, nothing like the big one, but continually. So after days of that, it was like you were punch drunk or something. You really felt ill. It was impossible to concentrate. Slowly, things began to return to normal. The stores stocked up again, and life went on as usual. And there was a couple of small quakes, and we were paying attention to things like radiation in the food and where food came from, basically. We would always check. But it seemed that things became stable once again and livable. There was a major quake, and not far from where the great Tohoku quake happened, in the same general area. The quake at Tohoku 311 was a 9 on the Richter scale, and this one on December 7th was around 7. So it was quite big enough to feel as before in the office I was working at in Daiba. And with that shaking and pounding and just the thought that, oh, this could happen all over again because there's 50 reactors in Japan. There's some that are very close to Tokyo. We couldn't do that again. I think I went back the next day and said that I was done. I think there were a few Japanese couples who did leave, perhaps. But as far as I know, almost all of the foreign couples I knew left. Sometimes I do miss living in Japan, and there is a certain dependability, trustworthiness, cleanliness, exactitude, precision. The way that they do things is sometimes so complete and so well thought of and conceived and executed, some things, that you really feel absolutely spoiled as a restaurant guest, hotel guest, customer, that kind of thing. That here, it's an utter disappointment, really, to eat. When you go to the convenience store and you buy a candy for 100 yen and they hand you back your change with two hands and they bow and they say thank you. You know, there's this a feeling of this respect that gets to be a burden as a person who must continually provide that respect. But as in the case of the consumer, that you would be the object of that respect, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. I'm not sure if I feel at home. Having said that, I don't know if that's what I wanted anyhow. I'm so used to being an outsider as a Japanese-Canadian anyways. As long as I have a little space and, four walls and all that, it's not such a bad position to be in.
A very special thanks to Junji for sharing his story. And it gives me great joy to thank as well Tally Abacasis, who produced this episode of Arrivals with us. Tally is the creator of First Day Back, an incredible audio documentary series which, along with Arrivals, is a member of the audio collective The Herd. If you haven't listened to First Day Back yet, please do yourself a favor and subscribe to it now. You do it yet? Okay. This episode of Arrivals was created across state and federal lines from Montreal to Manhattan to a hazy hilltop in the lovely Montecito Heights neighborhood of Los Angeles, California by me, Jonathan Hirsch. Our associate producer is Nora Lind, and illustrations for the show are from Steph Tan. If you want to know more about today's episode, visit our website. You'll find links to our Instagram and Facebook pages, updated almost daily with extras from the show, including our Arrivals microcast, En Route, featuring outtakes, extended interviews, and other ephemera from the Arrivals podcast. Like last week, when Sarah Curtis and I talked about the episode of Arrivals we produced together, Movements.
It's like taking this experience that I feel like I have in my life that sometimes feels poetic, but it's hard to have that translate. You're not just going to be like, hey, guy waiting for the train, like, do you hear the way that BART announcer is talking? And like, doesn't it somehow make you feel all these things? Like, because it doesn't, I feel like it doesn't really translate that way. But to actually build some sort of like work out of those moments, to me, it's a way of actually exploring how real / hyper real that feels, don't you think? It's like, do you have that experience ever?
Yeah, no, I totally do. And I think the fact that this is a story about life in the city sort of plays into that. Like we, especially living in New York, I think one of the things that always struck me was how privately we were all experiencing the same thing. I'm standing on the F train platform. Coming up the stairs, I hear the train pass. I'll likely be here for another 15 minutes. She's sitting on a milk crate, a coffee can stuffed with dollar bills in front of her. You hear the same announcer overhead. You see the same door open and close. You feel the same weather, and yet you're all doing it together privately. Sarah Curtis and I are starting a new project inspired by the episode of Arrivals we produced together, and we want you to be a part of it. Using a recorder or the voice memo app on your phone, we want you to record the things you hear on your way home. There's guidelines on our website. You can also sign up there for our newsletter, which has information about upcoming live shows, notes on the show, and so much more. And leave us a review on iTunes. It really does help spread the word. Even better, tell a friend about us. The show would not exist without your ears, so let's make this Arrivals thing a thing. You know what I mean? Go to our website. It's ARRVLS.com. This show is proud to be a member of The Herd, a storytelling audio collective featuring 6 producers from across North America who have banded together to share resources and to promote one another's work. Check out season 3 of Neighbors from Nashville producer Jacob Lewis.
It's raining, traffic's crazy, and I just walked or drove through a tunnel where a man's playing a tuba. The Tuba Man. I want to get to the bottom of this. I've heard about him. I've never seen him. This is the first time. And I'm going to find this Tuba Man.
And if you have a story of migration, transformation, or change you'd like to share with the program, email me at arrivalshow@gmail.com. However you spell it, I'll get it. Coming up on Arrivals.
Even though he had this persona of being very, very strict
grand.
And very grand, and that he was, always
the word.
He always was laughing with us and having a good time, and we enjoyed life.
I'm Jonathan Hirsch. Thank you for listening. And until we meet again, may you wind up where you need to be.